Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. If you have just joined us, you're tuned to Radio Islam International. And welcome to the program Family Health Matters. I'm your host, Sister Zeenat. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Now, just to briefly tell you what to look forward to for the next hour, inshallah. Well, first up on Family Health Matters is health news. I'll be talking to Mary Ducker, who is the Deputy Director of Public Health in the city of Johannesburg. She will be telling us more about the upcoming human papilloma virus vaccination and also the deworming campaign 2016 that the city of Johannesburg Health Department and the Gauteng Department of Health have embarked on, inshallah. That will take place in a few moments. And of course, that will then be followed by our interview with social worker Jamila Mohammed, who is also a visualization therapist. And our topic of discussion today, inshallah, is how visualization therapy can help with certain conditions, but in particular, drug addiction and relapse. Visualization therapy is the power of healing through mind and body connection. And remember, our lines will be open, and the number to dial is 011-854-1548. You can also SMS me or WhatsApp me on the number 082-8492-786. Well, back to our health news. The City of Johannesburg Health Department, together with Gauteng Department of Health, will be embarking in a campaign to provide the human papillomavirus, that's the HPV vaccine, to school-going girls. Now, joining me online is Mary Ducker, the Deputy Director of Public Health in the City of Johannesburg. Hi, good afternoon, Mary. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me, and good afternoon to our listeners.
Okay, can you just speak a little louder, Mary? I can't really hear you very clearly.
Okay. Good afternoon, and thank you for having me, and good afternoon to our listeners.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Now, we're going to be talking about the HPV vaccination and the deworming campaign. But for the benefit of our listeners, Mary, what is the HPV virus?
The human papillomavirus is a virus that causes the cervical cancer in women.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, so that's basically what we are going to be what the girls would be vaccinated against.
Yes.
With this virus. With this vaccination, I beg your pardon.
Against the human papillomavirus, yes.
Okay. Now, this campaign, I understand it's an annual campaign. Now, how long has this campaign been running, and have you seen any success thus far?
The campaign started in February 2014 in our country. It is conducted twice annually with an interval of 6 months. In terms of the success of the campaign, is a newly introduced vaccine, and it is a significant public health milestone for South Africa, and is expected to significantly contribute to the control of cervical cancer and reduce associated mortality within the next 2 to 3 decades. It means these kids that we are vaccinating now will only realize the benefits of the vaccine in 2 to 3 decades to come.
Okay. And how serious is cervical cancer, in South Africa?
In South Africa, the scientists are saying we have more than 5,000 new cases annually, and we have more than 27,000 deaths annually in our country, and the incident rate is 58.8.
Okay, so it is something of concern. And prior to the vaccine, what other vaccination, what other precautions were us, our women, supposed to be taking?
This virus is sexually transmitted. Therefore, women should guard against early sexual debut. Women should go to our facilities for regular pap smear screening, which will detect if they do have the virus or not. And women should also use protection in terms of condoms, because it is sexually transmitted.
Okay. Now, the campaign, I understand, or rather the theme of the campaign, is protecting South African girls against cancer of the cervix. It's only basically targeting young girls at public schools and special schools. Now, with regards to this, is the vaccine easily available for other age groups of people, for example, young women from 20 years and over?
Okay, currently our government is providing this vaccine only to girls 9 years and older in grade 4 public and special schools. We do not cover girls that are 20 years and older. And however, the vaccine could be accessed from the private service providers at a cost, of course. The reason why we're giving it to 9 years and older, because the success of this vaccine is said to be if the child is given the vaccine before the sexual the first sexual intercourse. If the child is already exposed to sexual intercourse, the vaccine therefore doesn't really give the expected benefits. Therefore, those who are not included in this campaign, those that are not in grade 4, 9 years and older, they can access it to from the private practitioners.
Okay, so basically what it is, this particular campaign is only for 9 years and older, girls from the age of 9 and older, for that matter.
Yes.
Okay, and that's only school-going children?
Only school-going children. We're not doing it at our facilities, not in our clinics. It's a school program that is conducted as an outreach to the schools.
Okay. Are there any side effects, with this vaccination? And are there perhaps any persons that cannot be vaccinated?
The vaccine itself is called Cervarix. The Cervarix has a good safety profile. Most reactions are mild, self-limiting, and disappear within few days after vaccination. The most common reactions are injection site pain, swelling in the arm, rash, redness, or itchiness may also occur. And we always educate the learners that they should not rub the injection site. They should not apply anything like Zambac or Vaseline on the injection site. Otherwise, they are mild. Reactions such as dizziness and fainting are very rare. In terms of contraindications, if a learner is hypersensitive or allergic to any component of the vaccine, should not be given. If a learner has a severe febrile illness, that is high temperature, we're not also giving the learner the vaccine.
And I think that's important for people to know about. And anyway, I do understand there's a deworming campaign taking place at the same time. How is deworming related to cervical cancer?
They are both school health services. They form package of what is given or provided to the learners by school health nurses. Other services include health screening, where the learners will be checked the ears, the eyes and mouth, but they are just health services provided to the schools.
Okay. The campaign itself, when does it start?
Actually, it started yesterday.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
And it will end 11th March 2016.
All right. And what is the procedure? You know, how does this happen? Can you just give us the whole rundown?
Okay. We have teams of nurses and support staff that are going out to each school, public schools. But before that, we gave the consent forms to the parents through the schools. Parents were expected to complete, sign the consent form to give permission that their children or learners should be vaccinated. However, if the parent or the guardian is not willing or is against the vaccine, we do not vaccinate. If the learner is 12 years old, is regarded as a person who can sign a consent form for herself. That would mean if the parent refuses consent, but the child would like to be vaccinated and the child is 12 years and older, she will give permission and we will vaccinate the girl.
Mm-hmm.
So in each school, quintal 1 to 3, grade R to grade 7, all the kids, boys and girls, will be given deworming, which is the prevention and treatment of the worms, like ringworms, roundworms, whipworms.
Mm-hmm.
Those are soil transmitted, targeting mostly preschool age children and school going children that could lead into some of health nutritional problems. So we're giving both kids, boys and girls, from quintal 1 to 3, grade R to grade 7. That is deworming. So when the kids bring back the consent form, they will give that to the schools or to the teachers, and when the nurses go to the schools, then they will find the completed form and they will then vaccinate the learners.
Okay. And the vaccination itself, how will this be administered?
The HPV is an injectable. It's injected on the deltoid muscles, that is upper arm. If the girl is left-handed, then the injection will be given on the right. If the girl is right-handed, the injection will be given on the left side. And the deworming is a tablet, one tablet.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, and I also understand, and I think you did mention it earlier, that it will be given in two doses,
yes,
the vaccination. So
yes.
Can you just explain that to our listeners as well?
We're giving it now in February, March,
mm-hmm.
and after a 6-month interval, we'll be giving the second dose of the HPV. It was found to be effective if it is given in two doses, meaning that if a girl received only one, the benefit of that vaccine will not be guaranteed. For the full benefit of the vaccine, the girl needs to get two HPV doses in a 6-month interval. So we will be going again for HPV2 around August and September this year.
Okay, and finally, you know, just your message for our listeners out there, please.
My message is for the parents, for the guardians, to please sign the consent form, because kids might lose out. We might miss out these kids if the consent forms are not completed and signed, because every child needs a consent form. Without a consent form, no vaccination. So parents, please sign the consent forms and return the consent forms to the schools so that they could be vaccinated. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much for all that information, Mary Dhaka. We certainly do appreciate it, and I hope our listeners have taken note of this. It's the Human Papilloma Virus Vaccination and Deworming Campaign 2016, and it will be taking, or it has started already, I believe, from yesterday, and it will be until the 11th of March. That would be the first phase of these vaccinations. So please listen, parents, if you did receive these forms, the consent forms, I think it's very important for you to sign and return them with your kid to school. Well, thank you very much, and we do wish you all the well, all the best.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. We take a break, and when we return, inshallah, we'll be speaking to Sister Jamila Mohammed, who is a social worker as well as a visualization therapist. Stay with us. We'll be back in a few moments. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. If you have just joined us, welcome back to Family Health Matters. I'm your host, Sister Zeenat. And my guest today will be Sister Jamila Mohammed, a visualization therapist, and she is a social worker as well. Now, the longer that people remain addicted, the more damage they will do to their body and their mind. If the individual keeps failing at one particular treatment option, they might want to try something different. Joining me online, alhamdulillah, is Sister Jamila Mohammed, and as I mentioned before, she is a social worker and she's a visualization therapist. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum salam.
How are you, Sister Jamila?
No, I'm well, thank you.
Okay, alhamdulillah. Jazakallahu khair for joining us on this program today.
Mm-hmm.
I said jazakallahu khair for joining us today.
Okay, I've got a clear line now.
Okay, is that better?
Yeah, that's much better.
Okay. I'm sorry about last week. I know we had to do a program with you last week, but we had to cancel it. But alhamdulillah, it's wonderful to have you with us online today. Now,
okay.
We want to talk a little about yourself first. Please tell us about your professional self.
Okay, I'm a social worker. I graduated at the University of Witwatersrand in 1981. I have been practicing social work since then. I've been mainly focusing in at the Department of Social Development and doing foster care and child and family welfare. I also then furthered my studies, and in the year 2009, I obtained my second degree at the University of Pakistan in the field of occupational social work. I then did a management course in advanced management through the University of Pretoria. And I recently, in 2014, did a course in visualization that is mainly neuro-linguistic training. And I qualified through the university in America, and it's basically mind-body connection.
Alhamdulillah. Yes, mashallah, that's quite a bit that you've been busy doing all these years, mashallah. But we want to talk a little bit. I know we did do a program on visualization therapy, I think sometime last year. We did have a repeat of that program, and we had many people actually requesting for more information with regards to this, and that is one of the reasons why we decided to do a program with you again. But tell us, before we even go into our program, we want to talk a little about drug abusers. Tell us about your work with drug. Is this part of your work? Do you deal with people, that are drug addicts?
Okay. I think the fact that I work in the area of child and family welfare, and if you work with families, you will inevitably be referred cases where individuals in the family are addicted and using or abusing drugs. And that is how the cases do come to us. Yes, I work intensively with these cases, but where the person doesn't want, I think we'll come to this one later, where we have in-service and out-service training, mm-hmm. and we would send the person into a rehabilitation center, and I work with them.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, how serious is the drug problem really?
Okay, if you look at some of the statistics that we've got, okay, about 65% of murder and violence in South Africa is associated with people who are either using alcohol or drugs. Then we look at The drug consumption in South Africa is twice the world norm. We actually known as one of the countries with the highest abuse of substance abuse. 15% of the South African population has a drug problem. Drug abuse costs the South African economy a lot, so we're spending about over 20 billion a year, okay, on, you know, to deal with the problem of substance abuse, which if you look at it is even a bigger threat than we have with the AIDS pandemic. The recently, you know, recent release from the United Nations World Drug Report has named South Africa as one of the drug capitals in the world. So I think that should give you an indication of how bad the problem is in our country.
Well, certainly that sounds very, very scary and really something to be concerned about. And I hope that many people out there are realizing, you know, what how serious this condition is, and you know, going out there and trying their best to be able to help in some way or the other to try and curb this, inshallah. Okay, we're going to take a short break, Jamila, and when we return, inshallah, we will continue with our program. A reminder to our listeners, if you have any questions or concerns, please feel free to contact us. The number to dial is 011-854-1548. We also have an SMS number, which is 082-8492-786, and you can also WhatsApp us on that same number. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a few moments. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to Family Health Matters. And joining me online today from Johannesburg is Sister Jamila Muhammad, who is a social worker, as she mentioned earlier, as well as a visualization therapist. And we're going to be talking to her about that, what visualization therapy is all about, you know, some of the conditions that it actually helps with. And also, in particular, we want to talk about drug addiction and relapse, and how visualization therapy, you know, actually can help, inshallah. Now, thank you so much, Sister Jamila, for holding on. We want to continue now. Let's look at the levels of intervention with drug users. Can we, you know, talk about that a little?
Okay, look, when we talk about the levels of intervention, it means at which stage or which level do you actually start addressing the problems of drugs? Now, the first phase would be prevention. That is the preventive talk that you have, things that they have as a guidance teacher in school, or the parents would be talking to the children and say, you know what, you don't take drugs, it's addictive, it's wrong, it's not something that you're going to do. The second level is the early intervention. This is where the mother would notice that her son comes home from school and he comes home late, or his eyes are red, or he's becoming increasingly abusive, and then she would immediately try and do something about it. She would seek the help of a counselor, or she would, you know, get help to assist her child. The third level is when the problem has become really bad. The person is abusing drugs, he's getting involved in criminal behavior, he's not coming home regularly, he's violent at home, and he doesn't want help, he doesn't want to seek help. And then you take, you need statutory intervention. This is when you use the assistance of the court, okay, the magistrate's court, so that you work with the magistrate's court and the social worker to do an assessment report and assist in admitting this person to a drug rehab so that he can try and get help.
Mm-hmm. And basically, this is what this is where your department comes in, the strategy level?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes?
Yeah, because it is a government department. That is the Department of Social Welfare, and they would get involved at the third level, the statutory intervention, where they would take the case to the court.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, Let's look at now the different stages of drug rehabilitation. When does rehabilitation come in?
Okay, look, let's say, for example, you report to the social worker that I have a problem and I think that this person in my family is abusing drugs. The very first thing we do is we deal with the case at the assessment phase. Okay, where I would actually investigate and find out what is happening, is this person taking drugs, and try and have regular meetings with you, with the family, with the person involved, and try and assess what the problem is. Then you find out that yes, he does have a substance abuse problem and he is taking drugs. So then you ask the person to go in for detoxification. That is, detoxification can be done at a government level, at SANCA, and that is when the person will actually be put onto medication and receive counseling and things like that. When you find that the person does not benefit from outpatient clinic, from the outpatient services and does that, then you would refer him to a rehabilitation, like, for example, to Makhali's, or they've got new rehab now in Didier or those areas. Then the other phase that is very important, and that is where I would really come in, is the post-rehabilitation services. Now, say, for example, the person has been in a drug rehab. He has been taken off the substance abuse and they have done counseling, they've worked with him, they've worked with the family. But the person has not yet been back into the home. He's not yet back into his work, or he may have lost his employment. So the family would come to me, I would find out how willing and ready are they to actually take the person back. Remember, before he went into the rehab, he was very violent, he was stealing, he was breaking things at home, he was fighting with his wife, and she may not want him back. Mm-hmm. So you've actually got to prepare the family on the fact that he's coming back, post-rehabilitation services. Then you've got to work with the client, you've got to work with the person to say, hey, do you have a job? Do you have any skills? How can you occupy yourself? If for him to be sitting at home, obviously he's going to be wanting to go back on drugs. So you actually start the developmental area with the client. So that is very, very important, and that you work with the client, and you actually, you know, looking at post rehab. The other thing is, at this stage, this is mainly where my services do come in. What I do is, the person will come to me for, while he's coming to me for counseling. And as you know, that substance abuse, okay, is a mind-body connection thing. It's mainly controlled by the brain. So, you know, physically, removing the person from drugs, he may still get withdrawal symptoms. And I think it's at this stage, besides the intensive counseling that is being done, you would offer visualization therapy. That means you would take the client into a deep state of visualization, okay? Mm-hmm. And then you would use the power of the mind to assist the client. So you would actually, when he's calm and relaxed, then you would use a negative association with the drugs. For example, you would actually say that you would make that something that the client will not touch. For the Muslim clients, I know that this is something that a lot of people don't really, you know, ever since you brought up as a child, the first thing you taught is you will not eat haram food. You will not eat anything that is not acceptable. You will not touch pork. And as a result, the child, the brain has accepted that concept, that pork is haram. I will not touch it. I will not use that. And then you link, you do linking. So you will say to the client that you will not touch drugs, and you link it to the haram food, and you say drugs, and the linkage, and you say drugs is pork, pork is drugs, drugs is haram, pork is, you know, you do a linking for things. But that, remember at that stage, the drug is, the client is in a state of deep visualization. And the brain accepts the message. So automatically when the client relapses and tries to go back to using drugs, the mind would reject that. He would, hopefully they will not take the drugs again. I think the very same concept I use with people who, for example, abuse chocolates or any of those things, and you use the same thing, and I found that they will not touch that again.
Okay. Just before you continue, now talking about visualization therapy, it's something to you're basically working with the mind of the person. Now I want to ask you this question, and I'm sure you've heard it many a times also. Is it connected, or is it anything similar to hypnosis?
I think a lot of people think of hypnotherapy as stage hypnotherapy, where the hypnotherapist controls the individual. He would say jump, and the person would say jump, and he'll jump, and, you know, all these things happen on stage, and it's very funny. But I think with this, it's similar to hypnotherapy, but it's not hypnotherapy. The client is conscious all the time, and you interacting with the client. So you would be saying things to him, and he would be responding. So the client is very, very conscious. It's like neuro-linguistic training. It's exactly what you can say, neuro-linguistic training.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very, very interesting. But now, you know, we know that many a times, almost, you know, people that go for rehabilitation at some stage or the other, you know, go into relapse. What are some of the signs of relapse?
Okay, look, when you look at relapse, you know, you have some of the first sign of relapse. Say, for example, the person comes out of the drug rehab, and for the first 4 or 5 weeks, he's so good, he's at home, he's just back to normal, the most loving, caring person. And then suddenly you start noticing a change. You'll see the person saying, you know what, in my days, I was a mover. I could do things. And, you know, his whole attitude starts changing. He goes back to his past, what he could do. Or the person believes that he's strong enough to take drugs again without falling back. You know what he'll say to you? Me, I'm completely in control of my body. I know what I'm doing. I don't need a social worker saying to me that I need to be careful, or I need counseling, or that I'm going to relapse. Then thirdly, you would get, you suddenly notice that this person is associating with all his old friends. That the old friends that used to abuse drugs with are now coming back. And you know that the connection with the friends who influenced him negatively is starting again. The fourth is that he becomes defensive. They'll say to you, Mommy, stop nagging. There's nothing wrong with me. I think you're just overreacting. He becomes very defensive. Mm. Or there will be a complete pattern of denial. And I think that is important. The denial is both with the, sometimes with the family and the addict. You know, this can't be happening. I am not going back. My son can't be taking drugs again. Or you'll get a change in attitude and behavior. So the first thing is he'll start coming home late at night. He starts becoming untidy. He doesn't control himself. He doesn't you know, the smart dressing and the standard of hygiene starts dropping. You also notice that the person may start experiencing a feeling of depression and loneliness. And he actually sort of starts withdrawing from the family, withdrawing from people. And there will be a break of social relations, right? Mm-hmm. Then you know that, you know what, there's something that's different. He isn't doing the things he used to do. Beginning to feel extremely stressed out and constantly tense, irritable. You can't say anything and it snaps at you. Then you must know that, you know what, this person is going into a relapse again. Mm-hmm. and there'll be a resentment towards those that are trying to help him. You people are on my back again. Just leave me alone. You know, he'll normally say that to his mother or to any person that is caring about him. And then you'll notice that the withdrawal symptoms actually start reappearing, shaking of the hands, the tremors, all those things.
Okay.
And they actually have a lot in belief. They say, you know what, this whole addiction recovery treatment that I went for as a rehab is just a waste of time. I don't believe in it. I don't believe that anybody can help. So then you know that, you know what, these are the early signs of relapse.
Mm. Okay, so basically when all these signs appear, you know, you should know that your child is, or your child, whoever the person is, the drug addict, is in relapse. But what is it that actually makes a drug addict keep relapsing?
Look, I think that the addict needs a lot of support, and he needs a lot of support, not only from in the form of being given detoxification and medication and whatever. There's got to be a lot of support from the family as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find that very often the addict will be at home and he doesn't have anything to do, he doesn't feel worthwhile. The father will say, oh, I don't know, from all my sons, you are a loser. You always do these things. All my other children are so bright, and you're the one that, you know, there's always a judgmental attitude. And I think instead of that, what we need is we need a lot of support and counseling with the family and the addict, and especially when they come back from the rehab or the outpatient treatment, so that they feel good about themselves and they continue on the line of prevention.
Mm-hmm. Just another question that comes up, and I just wanted to ask you this. It's with regards drug addiction, relapsing. What are the dangers of repeated relapses?
What are the basis of continuous relapsing?
Yeah, what is the dangers of it? What happens when, you know, and it happens so often that, you know, a drug addict is taken to a rehab, he comes back, he relapses, takes back, go back, you know, this thing continues all the time. So every time goes, comes back, relapse,
mm-hmm.
goes back again. So what are the dangers of this continuously happening?
Look, I think that you do understand that while the person does relapse, he's going to go back to all his old habits.
Mm.
That means he's going to start probably becoming abusive at home, he's going to start stealing, he may even start doing things that are inappropriate, and there's a danger that the person could affect himself both physically and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there is a connection between continuous drug usage and bipolar behavior. They call it the chicken and egg situation. We don't know whether the person was bipolar and then eventually started using drugs, or because of the long-term usage of drugs, he actually developed psychiatric conditions. Look, at this stage, I think something that's very important is that the family has to realize that the relapse warning signs for the co-addict, that is the family. Now, when I say co-addict, I don't mean that the family is you're taking drugs with the person. Co-addiction doesn't mean that you're sitting there and taking drugs with the addict. What happens is a co-addict is a person that would enable, not consciously, but subconsciously, enable the drug user to continue with his habit. Say, for example, every time the drug user gets into trouble, what does the co-addict does, the family members run to the prison and remove the place the bail and takes him out.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, the co-addict maintains the drug addict's behavior. And this co-addict very often would also show symptoms of relapse. So some of the symptoms of the co-addict will be like situation loss of daily structure. So, for example, they've got a person in the home or in the family using drugs, and then they will say, you know what, I don't know what to do anymore. I don't know where to start. I don't know what to focus on. I don't have any more ambitions, or, you know, I just don't feel like doing anything. So they lose only their daily structure. Or even the person, the family, the very person associated with the drug user would actually then say, you know what, I'm not interested. I don't do the things I used to go. I don't want to go and sit at the hairdresser anymore and make myself feel good. I've just given up. I've given up on the way things are happening. Or there's a lack of constructive planning. That means, you know, normally you know that you get up in the morning, you do this, you do that. Say, you know what, I don't care anymore. I just don't care. I can't be bothered. And that is one of the things that the co-addict will do. Or fatigue. They will say, you know what, I am so tired. I just feel I can't, I don't have any motivation left. And return to unreasonable resentments. For example, she would say, you know what, when I was bringing up my children, you know, when the child was very young, when they were 3-4 years old, and at that time we were living with my mother-in-law and all that, and what really happened is, I think my mother-in-law was very demanding, and I didn't have time with the little child, and as a result, this is it. It's unreasonable. It's an unreasonable resentment. You say, because of her now today, look what's happened. So there's a lot of that as well. And also a tendency to control people. There'll be defensiveness. There'll be self-pity. The person may say, you know what, when I get up in the morning and I know that he's again drugged, he's screaming at me and there's all this going on at home, all I do is I just open my cupboard and I start eating. I just can't control myself. Look how fat I'm getting. So that is one of the things. And there would be sleep disturbance. Say, for example, the mother will say, I went to the window and I stood there and it was 2 o'clock in the morning and he was still not home. I was so worried. You know, I'm hardly sleeping these nights. By the time I go to sleep, it's already morning. So the mother or the person living with the addict will also be affected in that way. And they have a failure for interpersonal support system, you know, and they, you know, as a result, they experience loneliness and isolation. I don't want to even go to friends anymore. I don't want to go to weddings and all, because the first thing they ask me is, how is my son doing? Is he still doing all those things? You know how embarrassing is it? So then the mother will say, I'm just now started staying at home. I'd rather not mix with anybody. And these are all the things that happen and how it affects. Now, both the family and the addict will be in post-rehab service counseling. These issues are dealt with by the counselor. Mm-hmm. And you actually work on them and you try and assist them to come to terms with what is happening.
So basically, it's really very important for you to be able to work, you know, hand in hand, you know, especially if you have a child or a son or a daughter or a family member for that matter, that is undergoing rehabilitation. It's very important for the family to, you know, work with the respective people involved, trying to help the drug addict to obviously come out clean from it completely.
That's correct.
Okay. Anyway, we don't have much more time, so I'm going to give you a few minutes quickly to tell us, you know, when do you actually see your clients?
Okay, I see my clients mainly on a Saturday and Sunday, mm-hmm. or after hours, and I see them at my office in Parkview, because I am doing this privately. Yeah.
And are you contracted to medical aids?
Yes, I am. I'm contracted to all medical aids.
Okay. And would you care to share your details for our listeners to be able to contact you, please, Sister Jamila?
Okay. If they're going to contact me by email, it's jamilatherapy Okay, now let me give you my phone numbers rather. 011-486-6024. And my cell phone number would be 082-414-6865. The email is Jamila Therapy at gmail.com.
Okay, is it Jamila? L-A-S or is it just Jamila?
J-A-M-I-L-A.
Okay, Jamila Therapy at gmail.com. Okay.
All small letters.
Yeah, okay. And I have your cell number, but I don't have the other number that you gave. 486?
60-24. And I've got one more number, 011-355-9535.
Okay. I'll just go through those numbers again. It's 082-414-6865. The other number is 011-486-6024. And the third number is 011-355-9535. We will have these numbers available for you at the station, so if you would like to get the numbers, then please do call us. We will share the contact details with you. And, of course, also the email is jamilatherapy@gmail.com. Well, Jazakallah, Jamila, for a wonderful and informative program. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Islam International.
Jazakallah
khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And that brings us to the end of our program today. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.